and question Mama again after that morning. I wanted to protest more, and I always planned to. I just didn't know how I'd survive once the food dried up. Even with those scant added calories, every now and again I'd find myself lightheaded in a field, or so exhausted I'd have to sit and rest mid-task. Without that little bit of extra sustenance, I knew I could never keep up with the work my parents needed me to manage in order to keep the farm going. So instead of digging for the truth from my parents, I quietly added yet another stream of terror to the river of it that ran beneath each hour of my life. Sometimes when I was planting or weeding or harvesting in the vegetable field, I'd stand to stretch my aching back, and when I looked to the sky, I'd notice a rising tower of black smoke. At first, this barely caught my attention, because there had been smoke on the horizon all the time when the occupation first began. But I gradually noticed that this was different from the smoke that rose when the Nazis destroyed our buildings with fire, because that came and went and moved around. And this odd smoke was always in the exact same place. It was initially an occasional landmark, but as 1 year under Nazi rule became two, the smoke became visible almost every day. Gradually, I made the reluctant connection between that odd tower of smoke and an awful smell that hung heavily in the air some days, like a sickly blanket across the whole district. When the smoke was billowing and there was no wind, that god-awful stench was never far behind. This was a scent unlike any other, not something I could identify, but something that made me feel physically ill and sometimes inexplicably scared. Soon, I didn't want to so much as look at the black line of smoke against the deep blue of our skies, as if the very sight of the smoke was a threat to me. On cloudless days, I could sometimes trick myself into believing that we had gone back in time, back to the years before Tomas left Chebinya. On one such day, I'd been working with my hands, but my thoughts had strayed elsewhere. I'd imagined that Tomas might wander down the hill, whistling, to join us for lunch and make my father laugh with some outrageous tale from his high school life. Or that Felipe might bound in from the far field to beg Mama to let him go to Justina's for a visit. I stared up at the sky and ignored for a moment the way that I'd been tired for so long. I'd forgotten what refreshed felt like. Mama and I had been weeding in the morning, but when we emerged from the house after lunch, my hopeful, wistful mood deflated in an instant when I saw that the smoke had started. By afternoon, as we planted on the other side of the vegetable field, the black-gray line had risen so high that it seemed to stretch all the way across the sky.
"Stop looking," Mama snapped at me suddenly. "Looking at it won't make it go away."
I flushed, then glanced at her and saw the scowl on her face. I could tell she didn't like its presence any more than I did, so I dared to ask for the first time.
"What do you think it is?"
"I know what it is. It's from a work camp for prisoners," Mama said abruptly. "Just a furnace."
"A furnace?" I repeated, glancing at the tower of smoke again and frowning. "That must be a very big furnace."
"It's to heat the water," she told me. "There are many prisoners in the camp, mostly prisoners of war. They are just warming water for the showers and the laundry."
This seemed to make sense, so I told myself there was nothing at all to fear in that tower of smoke, that my visceral reaction to it was in fact an overreaction, that I had been right in trying to ignore it altogether. But when I saw it again the next day, and the day after that, and soon it was there day and night, some deep part of me knew that my mother was wrong. I still didn't know what the smoke represented, but I was increasingly certain that it was yet another sign that the noose around the neck of my nation was being tightened. We heard of Felipe's death only by chance. The twins had been placed together on an immense work farm hundreds of miles away from us, working with young people from all over Poland,
one of which was assigned to camp administration. This man was later promoted by the Nazis to a more senior post in Krakow. On his way to the new position, he came through Szczebinia and sought us out. Just a few months after they arrived at the camp, Felipe had been outraged by some happening in the camp and had tried to intervene. Unsuccessfully, because, of course, the camp was heavily guarded and several soldiers turned their weapons on him in an instant. His death didn't feel at all like an inevitability to me, although in hindsight, maybe it should have. There was nothing to bury, no body to conduct a service over. Instead, we heard that he was gone, and that was that. There was no verification, no official notification. Just silence, where there had been silence for many months anyway. Nothing had changed, except that nothing was the same anymore, because once I had two brothers, and now I had one. This was what the occupation did to families. It shattered them into pieces without closure or explanation. Occasionally, as with Emilia and Truda, random pieces got stuck back together in a whole new way. But mostly, our oppression was loss without reason and pain without a purpose. My parents seemed to retreat into themselves after this, and we all just lived and worked in that tiny little house without ever directly discussing the agony of it all, each of us carrying the burden of our grief alone. I kept moving forward, only because I clung to a thread of optimism that just wouldn't die. Perhaps the resistance would make an impact. Perhaps Stanislav would come home. Perhaps Tomas would find his way home. Every time Father went into the town, I'd wait breathlessly by the door. "Any news of Tomas or Stanny?" I'd ask, and he'd shake his head and often give me a soft kiss against my head or a hug.
"Sorry, Alina, not today."
"Did you ask?"
"Everyone I could, child, I promise."
And then, just when the worst of my grief for Felipe was easing, Father came home from a trip to pick up our rations. It was winter by then, and there was snow all around. So I'd finished tending the animals by mid-morning, and was hiding inside by the fire, darning socks with Mama. I heard the creak of the gate opening and I ran to the door to greet Father as I always did. But the slump of his shoulders and his red-rimmed eyes said it all.
"Tomas or Stanny?" I asked numbly.
I saw Father look beyond me into the house and I followed his gaze. Mama had risen from her seat and the color was gone in an instant from her face. And then I knew that she'd read the truth in Father's eyes. Communicating with him without a word, in that way they had perfected after 30 years of marriage. She let out a wail as she sank to her knees and covered her face with her hands. I looked back to Father and shook my head.
"No,"
I whispered. He gave a heavy, shuddering sigh.
"Stanny,"
he choked as his eyes filled with tears.
"Dysentery."
Almost overnight, it was as if my brothers had never existed at all. It was one thing for the Nazis to have the power of life or death over us, but this preternatural ability to entirely erase two young men who had meant so much to us? Just like that. My parents had gone from a family of 4 children to a family of 2 daughters. Any parent would struggle with the loss, but for a long time, Father was caught in an overwhelming depression. I'd catch him standing in the fields, staring into space, and Mama sometimes had to force him to eat his sparse ration. When Truda, Mateusz, and Emilia visited with us on Sunday, Father would sit apart from the rest of the family, staring into space. It was as if he'd given up. I feared that war had taken his sons and his name would no longer continue after he was gone. So he no longer saw the point of carrying on at all. Mama herself was courageous during the day, but I'd wake sometimes at night to hear the quiet sobs she could no longer contain. All I had left to hope for was Tomas. I'd always thought of him as my whole world, but when everything else around me became ugliness and grief, I pined for him with an intensity that frightened me. I was furious with God that he had let these things happen to my country, and often during the day I'd promise myself that I would never pray again. I didn't want to be a Catholic anymore. I didn't want to be a person of faith anymore. If God would let such terrible things happen, I wanted nothing more to do with him. But every night I relented, and every night I made a silent truce, at least with Mother Mary. Just for a moment or two, I put my anger and my confusion aside so I could plead with her to intercede for me and to keep Tomas safe. But I no longer asked my father to ask after Tomas in the town, and I no longer prayed for news of him. Every other piece of news in those past months had changed things, and never for the better. So I told myself that even deafening silence was preferable to noise, if the noise always ended in grief.
Chapter 10. Alice. I convinced Mom to go back to her house a second time to bring her own iPad in for Babcia. Eddie needs his, so we can't leave it behind, but it doesn't feel right to leave Babcia without a voice. Mom gets the iPad, then I search for the AAC app in the App Store. It's an insanely expensive app, almost $300. Mom grumbles when she sees the price, but she puts her password in and buys it anyway. Once Babcia realizes what I'm doing, she hits the thank you button again and again. Finally, it's time to go home. All I can think about is getting Eddie settled and pouring myself a nice glass of wine. But Callie greets me at the door, blustering with fury.
You are not going to believe what happened to me today. It's an outrage.
Eddie looks like my child. The same green eyes, the same muddy blonde hair, the same essential features. Until his pediatrician put him on risperidone to try to help with his repetitive movements, Eddie even had my slight frame. Although he's 30 pounds heavier now, and so that slight frame is somewhat hidden these days. But Callie is all Wade, and she always has been. She's tall and broad, and she has the same shade of hair and cool blue eyes. She also inherited his intellect and his black and white perspective on life. What is it, Callie? I ask her with a sigh. She plants her hands on her hips, and her chin rises defiantly. I recognize the signs of indignation in my daughter, and I mentally brace myself. What is it today? Did someone dare to suggest she might be wrong about something again? Or maybe a teacher paired her with one of the slightly less gifted students for an assignment. Right on cue, Callie delivers an outrage.
There was a substitute teacher, and she made me do regular classwork, like I was a normal kid. It's a human rights abuse.
Eddie drops onto his beanbag in the front room. He rests the dreidel on his lap, and I realize that he's been carrying that thing all day now. I wish I'd asked for that woman's name from the store so I could send her a note to thank her. The remote is waiting right where he left it this morning, on the right-hand side of the beanbag. So he loads the YouTube app on the television, then navigates to a Thomas the Tank Engine video. He won't watch those in public anymore, and lately at school, he's been reacting violently if the teacher tries to put one on for him. She thinks he's socially aware enough to understand that he's probably a bit old to watch them, but he doesn't have the language to talk to us about that, so he only wants to watch them in private. That nearly breaks my heart. I'm glad he still binges on them at home, just as I'm glad I can leave him be now. He'll probably watch a half dozen episodes of the show before dinner. I think it's the Eddie equivalent of that glass of wine I so desperately need right now. I look from my son, who can't communicate, to my daughter, who can't help but communicate, and I sigh and grasp for patience. These moments of surreal disparity in my parenting obligations happen periodically, and I always manage to navigate them, but I feel my tolerance for this moment slipping through my fingers, and I grapple to get a handle on it. My reserve of patience becomes a life rope I just can't grasp, and I say the right words, but they come out too short, so that I fire the full force of my adult-grade sarcasm at my 10-year-old daughter.
I doubt it was regular classwork, Callie. I don't think they do regular classwork at an academic magnet school. It was regular work. It wasn't my advanced program, so it may as well have been finger painting to someone like me. It's the determined arrogance that gets me. It's the wide stance on her feet, the hands pinching into her hips, the jutted chin, the way her gaze keeps flicking to Eddie like she's trying to ram home the point. I'm your highly gifted child, not your special needs child. I deserve better than this because I'm bright, not challenged. I'm raising a monster, and that sudden realization makes me very angry. I mirror her stance and I say flatly, "One day of being treated like everyone else won't hurt you, Callie." I knew you wouldn't understand. Dad understands. Dad knows how frustrating it is to have unlimited intellectual potential and to be forced to do coloring in sheets like a... She pauses, then she looks at Eddie once more. But this time she lets her gaze linger before she says bitterly, "Like a retard." I hate that word so much. It's the connotations of uselessness that gets me. The imagery it inspires of padded cell institutions and children left behind. The very sound of it makes me see red. "Pascal," I snap, "go to your room now." Her nostrils flare as she stares at me, and then she bursts into tears and runs off up the stairs to her room. Wade appears in the doorway to the kitchen. He's wearing my apron, a white and neon pink number he got me for Mother's Day last year. Wade is so tall that the apron barely reaches the tops of his thighs. He's wearing it over his business shirt and trousers, and he looks completely ridiculous. But for the fact that I'm seething, I'd probably have burst out laughing at the sight of him. Instead, I stare at him, and I hope he's going to say something, anything, to display even just a little empathy. "It's days like these," he says, starting exactly as I need him to, but finishing the sentence with an utterly disappointing focus on Callie. "I think we should think about streaming her into a class with older gifted kids who are operating at the same level as she is. She's not some regular gifted kid. She's highly gifted, so it's frustrating for her to have to..." "No," I say far too sharply. He falls silent, and I drag in a steadying breath, then try to soften my tone. This is a well-worn argument, because I'm determined that Callie has some age-appropriate friends as well as academic challenge, and Wade seems to think friends are somewhat overrated and just wants her to work at the limit of her potential. "I'm sorry. I just can't have this conversation again. Not today. Please. Tomorrow?" He hesitates, then nods, and he belatedly asks,
"Okay. How did it go with Babcha?"
"I'll tell you about it once I eat," I sigh. "What are you cooking? Something smells good?"
"It's just some chicken steaks and vegetables."
He leads the way into the kitchen, and I see the chaos. Pots and pans all over the benches, open packets of ingredients on every conceivable surface, even offcuts from vegetables on the floor. This man literally understands how to create and manipulate nanoparticles to do all kinds of semi-magical medical and industrial things, but he cannot get his head around the rule that if you drop something, you pick it up. But I can't yell at him about the kitchen being messy, because technically he's helping me right now, even though I know he will serve up the meal, eat it, and then retire to his study to catch up on the work he missed this afternoon. And I'll be left with the disaster zone of a kitchen. That's a problem for later. He's in the kitchen now, and so for now, it's his problem, and I'm going to snatch some time for myself while I can. I walk straight to the cupboard, withdraw a bottle of Merlot, and pour myself a glass. "Wade," I say. He looks at me expectantly, as if I'm about to praise him or thank him. He is visibly disappointed when I instead ask, "Can you bring me a plate of dinner when it's ready?"
"Going to eat in the bath tonight?"
The man has some redeeming qualities. At least he knows me every bit as well as I know him. "I most definitely am. Do you have a problem with that?" Wade smirks, then shakes his head.
"Honey, we've been married a long time, so I'm very aware that there's not much you won't do in a bathtub."
I drink half the wine in one long gulp, then top the glass off before I take a few steps toward the door. An afterthought hits me, so I turn back to the cupboard, withdraw a can of soup, and pass it to Wade. "Eddie needs to eat, too. See you soon. Thanks, and don't skimp on the potato."
I soak in the bath until my skin has wrinkled. It's my only refuge sometimes, and Wade is right. There's not much I can't accomplish as the relaxed bathtub version of myself. I do hours of reading whenever we encounter a new challenge with Eddie, and most of the time I do that on the iPad or my Kindle here in the bath. Wade used to worry that I'd electrocute myself one day, so he installed a spring-loaded cable to the ceiling. Now if I drop my device, it bounces up instead of falling into the water. This place, the gleaming white tiles, the soothing weightlessness of the water, the magnificent restorative silence. This is where my thoughts flow uninterrupted. Callie knows not to disturb me in the bath, and although Eddie will eventually seek me out if he needs me, most of the time he'll just sit in whatever problem he's gotten himself into until I come find him. That's an issue most of the time. It's a blessing when it comes to my bath time. I luxuriate in the bath. I am still in the bath, completely motionless, but for the gentle movements of my arms as I read. In every other sphere of my life, I constantly feel like I'm rushing. But not here. This is the only treat I give myself, but I take it greedily. During stressful periods, I take a bath every single day. And yes, on days like today, I'm not above a glass of wine or two here, or even dinner. I can't say chicken steak is a particularly bath-friendly meal, but I make it work. Then, when the water has cooled for the second time, I sigh and return to the real world. Next, I convince Eddie to take his melatonin, the only way he'll sleep more than a few hours. Then, I convince Eddie to half-clean his teeth, a task he still hates, even though I've tried every special needs toothbrush, toothpaste flavor, and technique known to humankind. Then I convince Eddie to climb into bed, and once he's settled, I call past my daughter's room. She's reading. She's always reading. So much so that it's a challenge to find texts that are complex enough to engage her, but don't cover themes that are just too mature for her emotionally. Tonight, she's engrossed in The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy for the umpteenth time, and when I kiss her goodnight, she barely looks up from the page. Not ready to apologize yet, then. I know it'll come, so I tell her I love her and leave her be. There's no more prolonging the inevitable. That kitchen needs attention, so I head there next. It takes over an hour to undo the damage Wade did cooking tonight, and just as I suspected, he's nowhere to be seen. I try not to resent that, because he did help me out today, and in doing so, he significantly exceeded my expectations. Still, my thoughts wander back to Bobcha as I clean, and I think about how much easier this whole situation would be if Wade was different. Wade, not Eddie. I can't let myself wish Eddie was different. Even letting that thought linger in my mind would feel like a betrayal to my son. When I finally wander into the bedroom Wade and I share, I'm surprised to find he's in the bedroom too. I assumed he was in his study working, but he's had a shower and he's pulling on his pajamas. I sit on the bed and watch him dress.
"Want to talk about it?"
he asks softly. The offer is surprising, but it's most definitely welcome. I lean back into the pillows and tuck my legs up, then wrap my arms around them, pulling myself smaller as if that will make me stronger. Bobcha keeps asking for Pa.
"Poor Bobcha," Wade sighs. "Has she forgotten?"
"I don't think so. Mom thinks she's confused, but I'm starting to think she wants something else. Maybe she wants some information about Pa, but she doesn't know how to ask."
"That sounds pretty frustrating."
"It is," I sigh, and now dressed in his pajamas, Wade approaches the bed and sits up beside me. He turns me slightly, and I shift to give him access to rub my shoulders. The pressure and the kneading feel amazing, but just as I start to relax, he drops a gentle but lingering kiss against my neck. There's a subtext in that kiss, an offer and a request, and it irritates me to my very bones. Seriously? He thinks I'm in the mood for sex after the day I've had? I try to maneuver subtly out of his way and keep talking as if I didn't notice the kiss. I honestly don't know what we would have done if it wasn't for Eddie's AAC app. Her right hand doesn't seem to be working the way it should. I don't think she can write.
Uh-huh.
The thing is, what could she possibly want me to find out? She lived an entire life with Pa. What question did she never think to ask him? After 70-plus years with someone, how can they still have secrets from you? There's a moment of silence as my husband ponders this. Then he says cautiously,
"You have secrets from me, and we've been together for well over a decade."
"I don't have secrets from you," I say stiffly. Wade sighs and drops back to sink into his pillows. I turn around and frown at him. "I don't."
"You're angry at me all of the time, and most of the time I have no idea why."
"Seriously, Wade? You have no idea why?" He raises his eyebrows at me.
"Go on," he says, taunting me. "Get it off your chest. You're obviously wanting to vent. What is it today? Am I a shit father? I'm a shit husband? I work too much? I don't understand how hard your life is? I don't get what it's like to sacrifice your career?"
I glare at him. Then I stand, pick up my pillow, and head for the door.
"Go on, Alice," he calls after me, his tone flat. "Run away and feel sorry for yourself because Big Bad Wade tried to make you have an adult conversation."
"You asshole," I say, and I turn back to him from the doorway and scowl at him through my tears. "She's going to die, Wade. Babcia is going to die, and I don't know how to help her, and you picked today to try to address the problems in our marriage?" I see the brief flash of remorse cross his face as I slam the door and walk to Eddie's room. My son is curled up in the corner of his bed, but the duvet is on the floor beside him. It's weighted, and to me, uncomfortably heavy, but the pressure helps keep Eddie calm, although it also tends to slip off the bed when he's restless. I lift the duvet over his body and tuck him in, then reach under the bed and withdraw the trundle mattress. It's already made up, because I end up in here pretty often. Usually I come in here to help Eddie sleep, but tonight, it's for me. Maybe Wade is right. Maybe I am running away. But all I know is, I need comfort from him tonight, and not demands. And if I can't get those things, I'll settle for space instead.
Chapter 11. Alina. Since the invasion, the Nazis had been executing any citizen who provided Jews with material assistance. But when this failed to deter some people, they broadened the decree. Now they would execute the family of such a person, women and children included, for a crime as innocent as handing a Jewish person a glass of water. An entire family would now be slaughtered. We learned about this new ruling the same way we learned about many of the struggles in Sierpinia from Truda and Mateusz at Sunday lunch. It was snowing that day, and Emilia was wearing a black coat that was several sizes too big for her, inherited from one of the other children in their street. Her gifts of posies had stalled when the cold came, but Emilia still brought me a drawing each week, often on the back of propaganda pamphlets, because paper was increasingly difficult for Mateusz and Truda to come by. That week, she'd given me an artwork in charcoal, a shadowy image of a rose missing many of its petals. I had a pile of such pictures in my room now, the motifs increasingly dark as the world around us was drained of light. Now Emilia drew in charcoal all the time, and she drew flowers in various states of death, and occasionally sharp, bewildering abstracts. I still accepted each gift with a surprised smile, and she always looked so happy to have pleased me. The moodiness of her pictures concerned me, but I kept them all. I had a neat pile in the drawer with my precious ring. That day, the conversation at lunch was focused all around that new punishment for assisting Jews. Truda was sullen in her sadness, but Mateusz was visibly shaking in frustration. "It's just hopeless," Truda said miserably. "Every time I think it can't get any worse, they find new depths of cruelty."
"This will go a long way to discouraging those who are in the business of helping the Jews in hiding," Father murmured, and his gaze flicked briefly to me. "People are noble, but when you threaten someone's children, the very idea can make even the bravest man rethink heroic efforts."
"Why do the Nazis hate the Jews so much?" Emilia blurted in her usual fashion.
Everyone stared at her, searching for a way to respond until she slumped a little.
Why do they hate us so much? What did we ever do to them?
She was growing up before my eyes, each week a little less innocent than the last. She was a little shy of 9 years old, but Emilia sometimes seemed more grown up than I felt.
Hitler wants land and power, and it is much easier to convince an army to die for you when you have an enemy to fight,
Father said quite gently.
And the Jews make for an easy enemy, because people will always hate what is different.
Some people will help the Jews regardless,
Mama said suddenly. It felt as though she was trying to reassure us somehow.
Some will be undeterred by any punishment. Some will help them no matter what those pigs threaten us with.
And some are making so much gold from hiding Jews that even the threat of death to their families will not deter them,
Mateusz sighed. This was the first I'd heard of such an arrangement, and I was shocked.
Who would do such a thing?
They are the worst of our countrymen, Alina. Those who profit from the suffering of the innocent,
Mateusz said, suddenly scowling.
They are little more than pigs, just as the Nazis are.
Evil is closer to home than you think,
Mama murmured under her breath as she rose to clear her plate.
That's why we trust no one outside of this family.
There was no mistaking the undertone as she said it. My mother was implying something. I waited for someone to elaborate, but instead, my father shot my mother an exasperated glare.
We mustn't engage in rumors, Faustina. Gossip gets people killed in times like these.
Father's tone was dismissive, but I frowned at them.
Who are you talking about? Do we know someone who would do this?
Please leave it, Alina,
Truda said, nodding pointedly toward Emilia. I glanced at my little sister. She was watching me closely, and I suddenly felt embarrassed to be dismissed in front of her yet again.
I am so tired of you all treating me like a child, I exclaimed. You want me to pretend I am a fool, that I don't even have eyes in my head. Does no one in this family trust me at all?
We trust you,
my mother said stiffly.
It is everyone else we don't trust.
And Alina, you are only 17 years old. You have to accept that there are reasons for the secrets we keep from you.
I spoke out of turn. Please forgive me for that.
I don't keep secrets from you, big sister,
Emilia said hesitantly. Everyone looked at her and she raised her chin.
I tell Alina everything because she lets me talk to her.
I know you do, Babisu,
I said softly, and I reached across the table and squeezed her hand.
And you know I love talking to you.
Emilia nodded, then she frowned at the rest of the adults at the table, as if they'd let us both down somehow. Truda changed the subject then, and the conversation moved on, but long after our guests had left, I was still thinking about Mama's comment. I'd turned it over and over in my mind during the night, thinking of all the people we knew in the town and the surrounding farms. Some were easy to dismiss, people like Justyna's father, Jan, who had made his hatred for the Jews clear. But beyond that, everyone was desperate for food. Almost everyone was desperately poor, too, and gold could buy food on the black market. Despite Mateusz's disgust, I could imagine virtually anyone we knew agreeing to hide Jews if there was good money to be made. I followed Mama out to the well the next morning when she went to fetch water, and as soon as we were alone, I asked her directly.
Who were you talking about last night when you said people we knew were hiding Jews for money?
I knew you would ask me today, Mama murmured.
Well,
I paused, then I said in frustration,
Mama, you have to let me grow up.
Even Emilia is growing up, but you and father keep me locked away like an infant.
One day, when this war is over, you'll look back and with the passing of time, these things that right now feel like unfair deceptions will seem like mercies, Mama said, and her gaze grew distant. It might not be much, but all we can offer you is to protect you when we can, and sometimes that means to relieve you of the heavy burden of secrets. One day you'll be grateful that we kept you busy and kept your focus on survival. One day, daughter, all of this suffering will be contained in your memories, and you'll be free. That seemed a dream too unlikely for me to waste energy hoping for it. I slumped even as she said it, and tears filled my eyes. I blinked them away, then whispered, "Do you really believe that?" She sighed sadly. "Alina, if I didn't believe that, I couldn't drag myself out of bed in the morning." Spring came again, but it was difficult to find any joy in the blooming of the wild flowers in the grasses around our fields. Mama and I again resumed our frantic schedule to prepare the new season's crops. But one day when we were working in the field together, I saw Justyna approaching the boundary of her property. She waved to me hesitantly. "I think your friend would like a chat," Mama murmured. "Can I go?" I asked. Mama nodded, and I scrambled to my feet and ran to greet her. "Hello," I said, excited at the prospect of a conversation with someone other than my family. "How have you been? I haven't seen you in months." "I know," she said, dropping her gaze. "Father has kept me busy. I am sure it is the same for you." "It is," I sighed, but then I noticed the purse of her lips. "Justyna, are you okay?" "My aunt? My mother?" she started to say, then she inhaled and said in a rush, "I don't exactly know what's going on, but I think my Aunt Nadia might know something about your Tomas." My stomach dropped to my toes because I immediately assumed the worst. "Oh no, Justyna. Is it bad news?" Justyna shook her head hastily, but then she shrugged. "I don't actually know. I just heard Father and Mama whispering. They were arguing. Father wants us to stay, but Mama wants to take me to go with her to her sister's in Krakow. She said it's too dangerous in the country these days. Father said something about Nadia, and then Mama definitely said Tomasz Szlaski. I didn't hear much, but I heard that bit clear as a bell." "Did you ask them what they were talking about?" I whispered through suddenly numb lips. Justyna nodded, then her gaze saddened. "They wouldn't tell me. Father got so angry when I asked, and Mama is very upset about something. She was crying so much last night. But you know my Aunt Nadia, Alina. She is so kind, and she has suffered so much loss herself. I am sure she would be sympathetic to your situation. If you found a way to see her, I know she would tell you what she knows." Nadia's house was just a few streets into Chebinje, right on our side of town. I could run there, talk to her, and still be home in under half an hour. I turned back to look at the house and saw Mama's eyes inevitably fixed on me. "I wasn't sure if I should tell you. I know your parents will never let you go to her," Justyna said, her eyes following mine. I swallowed as I nodded. "I couldn't not tell you, though. If Felipe, back before, well, if someone had news, any news, I would want to know." "Could I ask Truda to visit Nadia for me?" I dismissed the idea immediately. She would never court danger, not in a million years. But even if I could convince her to do it, I'd never forgive myself if Nadia was tangled up in something dangerous, and there were consequences for my sister and her family. Whatever news Nadia had of my Tomas,
I doubted she'd come across it without some risk.
What are you going to do?
Justyna asked me. I raised my chin just a little. The only thing I can do. It was an unseasonably cool night, and I'd left my window open so my parents wouldn't hear the squeal of the wooden frame moving when it came time for me to climb outside. I sat on my bed, fully dressed, but hiding in a nest of blankets, dreading the coming moment when I'd have to leave the warmth. There was a full moon, but patches of clouds were floating past. As I stared out the window and waited, I watched the moonlight come and go. How many stories had I heard over the months since the war began where someone had left home and simply never returned? Sometimes their families learned their fates, but often they were just lost. I couldn't ask Mama for my ID papers, and my parents would surely catch me if I tried to find them myself. So I'd have to make this run without my documentation, and it was well past curfew. If a soldier so much as saw me, I was done for. How would this story end for my family? Would my parents wake up tomorrow and find me missing and never know what became of me? They simply wouldn't survive without me. Not now that the boys were gone. The farm would fall to ruin, and the soldiers would take them away too. Or would I climb out the window, run quickly up the hill and down the other side, knock on Nadia's door without incident, and beg her to tell me what she knew? If it was bad news, at least I would know. I pictured myself making the return journey sobbing and felt my muscles tense. It was a real possibility that this trip was going to be an ending, not a beginning. I had long since convinced myself that no news was better than bad news, but that was when I had no chance of accessing any. Now that I knew there was potentially an update about Tomas waiting just on the other side of the hill, there was no way I could remain passive. I'd have walked through gunfire for that news. I just hoped and prayed I wouldn't have to. I had to take the chance, because this risk I was taking could change everything for me. If I knew where Tomas was, I could try to figure out how to get to him. And on that thought, I climbed carefully out through my window. The air was so cool, my breath escaped as mist. I swallowed my fear, looked toward the hill, and then I forced myself to run. I was slow and quite clumsy on any ordinary day, but adrenaline was on my side, and I moved as quickly as I could. I wouldn't take the path everyone else took, because it wasn't the fastest route, and I suspected that if I was going to be caught by some unexpected Nazi patrol crew, it would be on the established path. I'd never seen soldiers in the woods, but if they were going to be there, they'd never know that territory like I did. I'd climbed the hill 100 times at every point it could be climbed. The very best moments of my life had been spent at its summit, and I knew that space like I knew my own body. So I climbed the steepest part of the slope, the most direct route to town, but also the toughest ascent. I found myself completely out of breath before I'd even reached the top, but I forced myself to keep going, even as my lungs felt like they might burst. And my heart was pounding so hard against my chest that I was scared people some miles away would hear it. It was as I neared the summit that a prickling feeling rose across the back of my neck, and just as I identified it as the sensation of being watched, there came the sound of a twig snapping somewhere behind me. I told myself it was my imagination, but the sense that I wasn't alone did not abate even as I moved faster. And soon I was certain I could hear soft footsteps on the ground behind me. But was it imagination or paranoia, or was someone really there? I couldn't risk stopping to check. I told myself it was probably Justyna. Perhaps she was coming to join me? Then I told myself it was Mama or Father hot on my heels. For just an instant, that seemed like the worst-case scenario. Being caught by them would be terrible. Their disappointment and anger would be difficult to face. Rationality quickly corrected that notion, because of course being caught sneaking out by my parents was far from the worst outcome in that moment. And with those footfalls drawing nearer, I actually started to pray that my parents were indeed about to catch me, because I was sure now that someone was. Someone was most definitely chasing me through the forest. Someone who wasn't willing to call out to identify themselves. Mama or father would call out. So would Justyna. I no longer cared if I made it to Nadia's house. In fact, now I wasn't even sure I should go to Nadia's house. Even if, by some miracle, I made it to the top of the hill then down the other side in one piece. Because if it was a soldier pursuing me, what possible innocent explanation could I give for my midnight run through the woods to her house? Suddenly, I wasn't running to a place. Instead, I was running for my life. I had been afraid so many times over the course of the war, but in that moment, what I felt was deeper than mere fear. It was some instinctual, whole-body flight away from the danger. I was operating on the certainty that death was about to catch me, and I felt the terror of that knowledge in every cell in my body. When I neared the clearing, I heard my name. It wasn't a shout or even a call. It was quite a desperate whisper, and when the sound registered in my brain, panic, disbelief, and relief merged so suddenly that all of my thoughts went a little haywire. I was running too fast to stop suddenly, but I tried to do so anyway, at the same time as I tried to turn to see if I'd correctly identified the owner of the voice. Perhaps unsurprisingly, I ended up on my backside in the dirt, my head spinning as I watched my pursuer finally catch up to me and sink to the ground near me.
When I catch my breath, and when you catch yours, you're going to explain yourself, Alina Dziak,
Tomas panted. He sounded exhausted, but there was a vein of good-natured humor in his whisper.
How did you even know I was out here? I've been so careful. It was the eggs, wasn't it? I knew I'd taken too many. Are you angry that I stole from your family? I only did so because you have so many chickens. I didn't think they'd be missed.
I rubbed my head, feeling for the shape of a bump. Had I knocked myself out? I must have dreamed the last long minutes of being chased, and now I was hallucinating my deepest desire. But my fingers could find no bump. My bottom was throbbing, but the rest of me seemed unharmed. Except, if I wasn't hurt, why was I suddenly seeing Tomas? Had I lost my mind? I tried to talk, but the words stuck in my mouth. I was too confused to be hopeful. A shaft of filtered moonlight suddenly fell across his face, and I squinted at him, trying to make sense of what I was seeing. It was Tomas's hair, overgrown but familiar, and Tomas's beautiful eyes, shadowed because of the darkness, and Tomas's face, even if it was hidden under an unruly beard. Even before hope could dawn, I was inexorably drawn to him. I found myself crawling automatically across the ground, tears streaming from my eyes. I was still scared, but now I was simply scared to believe my own eyes.
Are you hurt? He asked,
and he scrambled the remaining distance to meet me. I reached up to touch his face incredulously, tentatively, just with the pads of my fingers, in case I made contact too sharply and he disappeared. But Tomas was not so hesitant. He cradled my face in his hands and he peered down at me, urgently scanning my expression in the semi-darkness.
Alina. God, Alina, please tell me you weren't hurt. I couldn't bear it. I'm sorry I chased you. I was trying to get your attention without shouting. But I didn't know what else to do. They can't find me here.
I continued to stare at him in disbelief, and he suddenly dropped his hands to my shoulders and he shook me gently.
Alina, my love, you're scaring me. Please tell me you're okay.
I did the only rational thing, given the circumstances. I thumped him. My hands were still in fists, and I beat the sides of them against his chest again and again as I sobbed.
Tomas, I'm scaring you. You scared me half to death.
He pushed my fists aside, but rather than pushing me away, he scooped me onto his lap and pressed my face into his shoulder as he whispered,
"Shh, I'm sorry, my love. I'm so sorry."
I pulled away from him to clasp the collar of his coat in both of my fists. Then I shook him hard. In the recesses of my mind, it registered how dirty he was. Beneath my fingers, I felt the roughness of dried mud in the wool of his collar.
"What are you doing here?"
"Hiding,"
he offered, giving me a slightly wry grin. I shook him furiously.
"Tomas, how long have you been hiding in the woods?"
"Shh."
His hushing was a little more urgent now because I was shouting in my bewilderment and my shock.
"Just a few weeks,
He peered at me, confused.
"Wait, you didn't know I was here? How did you find me?"
"Weeks,"
I gasped. Then I glared at him. "You have been here for weeks, and you didn't come to let me know you were okay? Do you have any idea how scared I've been?"
"Alina," he whispered, gently scolding me, "surely you knew I'd come back for you."
"I did know that," I protested, but then I started to cry all over again. "But I was scared. I was so worried that you were hurt, or maybe that you'd found another life somewhere."
He brushed my hair back from my face.
"I told you that last night before I left. We are meant to be together. I was always coming back for you, and I always, always will."
We both paused at that, and we just stared at each other, soft smiles on our faces. I wiped the tears from my face and made a resolution to myself to stop crying immediately, because there was plenty to cry about in those days. But from where I found myself that night, things instantly looked much brighter. I decided there would be enough time for recriminations later, so I cupped his scruff-covered cheeks in my hands, and I brought his face hard against mine so that I could kiss him. Oh, it was heaven to be with him again. Heaven to press my lips against his, and to breathe him in, all of him, the scent of the woods in his wildly overgrown hair and his clothes, and even the scent of his sweat, just because it was all Tomas, and it all made his return so much more real. By the time we parted, both of our faces were wet with tears. There are some moments in life that are distorted by anticipation. It has a way of warping our expectations, inflating them somehow. This was not one of those moments. Every single thing about the minute Tomas and I were reunited was just as delicious as I'd hoped, and sinking back into his arms was just as wonderful as all of the hours I'd spent dreaming had promised it would be.
"Where have you been?"
I breathed.
"In Warsaw at first," he said.
Then he sighed and said it again as he shook his head.
"Then, these last few months, I've been making my way back here to you. It wasn't easy to get back."
He was only 21, but his entire demeanor suddenly shifted. His shoulders were slumped, and now that I was sitting on his lap and close enough to see his face in the darkness, I could see that his cheeks were gaunt beneath his beard, and the sparkle had faded somewhat in those beautiful green eyes. Still, I loved him with a ferocity that almost frightened me. Dirty, starved, miserable, and weary, none of that even registered beyond a passing acknowledgement. I loved him so deeply that all I really saw was that he was mine again. Everything else in the world might have gone to hell, but that one fact was incontrovertible.
"It will be okay," I promised him. "We're together again now. That's all that matters."
"I know, my love, but you must understand. No one can know that I'm here. Not even your parents. I'm in some trouble.
he admitted. But before I could even think about what that might mean, it only occurred to me then that he probably had no idea about Alexei's fate, or how difficult life in the region had become for us all.
I have to tell you some things,
I whispered, staring right into his eyes. For just a moment, I could barely recognize the boy I loved. He suddenly seemed like an old man, weary and worn down by war and sadness.
If it is about my father, I have already heard,
he whispered. I exhaled, relieved that I didn't need to break the news to him. But the sadness in his gaze was so heavy that I had to look away. Tomas would have none of that. He slid his hands up over my shoulders and into my hair, then he cupped my cheek, and he turned me to face him again. Our eyes met, and butterflies began to dance in my belly at the intensity of the love in his gaze.
I know what your family has done for my sister, Alina, and how you saved her that day. I loved you before. You know I've always loved you, since before I even knew what that meant. But the way you have cared for her.
His voice broke a little, and he stopped, inhaled sharply, then continued unevenly.
If we weren't already engaged, I'd propose to you right this moment.
And I'd say yes again, I whispered.
I brushed my lips against his. But as he moved to kiss me properly again, I sat back a little.
Wait, Tomas, tell me about this trouble. Who is after you? Is it the invaders?
He sighed, but wouldn't allow distance to grow between us. In fact, he leaned forward and rested his forehead against mine. Then he closed his eyes. I closed mine too, and for a moment we sat together in silence.
Everyone, Alina. I wish I didn't have to tell you this, but I am in trouble with everyone,
he whispered hesitantly. The Poles, the Nazis. It feels like I have managed to anger the whole world. I wrapped my arms around his neck, wanting to hold him closer, but I opened my eyes to stare at him.
What on earth did you do?
I asked him hesitantly.
I made some mistakes in Warsaw, he admitted. I've been trying to make up for them ever since. I'm still trying.
I waited for him to tell me, but after a moment he opened his eyes and turned away, exhaled shakily, then glanced back to me, his gaze pleading.
I don't want to talk about that now, Alina. Please don't ask me to. There will be time for those discussions later. I just want to hold you. And for 5 minutes in this godforsaken war, feel like life is worth living again.
I could see the desperation in his gaze, and it broke my heart a little.
Why stare when you could kiss me?
I asked him. He brought his lips back to mine then, and it was everything I'd missed. And everything I'd needed over his absence.
Home, I kept thinking. I'm home.
Which made no sense at all since I'd been stuck within my home for what felt like forever by that stage. But Tomas's arms were a different kind of home, and I'd been homesick for that embrace for so long. When we broke apart some minutes later, he cupped my face in his hands again to stare into my eyes.
Alina. You know I'll always find you. Promise me you know that. I don't know what's ahead of us, but when we're apart, there's only one thing on my mind, and that's getting back to my girl.
I know. I feel the same, I promised him, and he kissed me once more.
Now you really need to tell me how you found me. Have I been careless?
I didn't find you. I was going to Nadia Novak's house, I said.
He stiffened immediately and pulled away from me just a little.
Why were you going there?
Justyna heard her parents arguing, and they said something about Nadia. Something about you.
I said warily. Tomas exhaled, then shifted away from me just a little. He was obviously troubled by this news, and I touched the back of my hand to his cheek gently.
Alina, he said, glancing at me warily, what do you know of Nadia Novak?
What do you mean? Of course I know her. She's Ola's sister, and I know her husband has died, and her children are mostly taken.
He was still staring at me, warily, but I shook my head.
Tomas, I don't understand. What do you mean?
That is all you know, he pressed, and I frowned.
What else is there?
I have to ask you to stay away from Nadia's place, please. And you must stay well away from Jan Goloshevsky.
I was only going to Nadia's to ask after you, Tomas. I have been so desperate for news. And this was the first hint of any I'd had in all of this time, so I had to try. And Father has long forbidden me from visiting Justyna at home, and he keeps me so busy I barely even talk to her in the fields. So you have no concerns there either, I told him softly. He nodded, then he pulled me close again and he pressed his face into my hair.
Tell me everything. Please, Tomas, where are you hiding?
He hesitated only a moment before he admitted, just in the woods for now. I wanted so much to let you know I was okay and that I was here, but I was scared doing so would endanger you. I thought if I waited here, I could keep an eye on your family and do what I could to be sure you were safe. And I have seen Amelia walking past on Sundays. So this, it is a very good spot for me. I am close and safe, but not endangering any of you by my presence.
Tomas, it's the woods, I said, shocked. There is nowhere to hide here. No protection from the weather. You can't possibly stay here.
I have a few spots where I can make myself invisible. The woods are too small for anyone else to bother hiding here, so it's not like the Nazis are sweeping the place every day. For the time being, it's fine.
How do you sleep?
He offered me a fond look at the concern in my tone. I manage, Alina.
And food? How do you...
I was thinking through the logistics of his situation, and the more it sank in, the more scared I was. Please, don't worry about me. There are so many who are far worse off than I am.
Mama always says the same, I said, suddenly frustrated. But Tomas, just because our suffering isn't the worst, that doesn't mean it doesn't count.
I kissed him once more, hard and fast.
Promise me you'll be safe.
I will, he said. But he said it too lightly, and I gripped his collar tight again.
You don't understand, Tomas. I just couldn't bear it if anything happened to you. Promise me and mean it.
I do understand, he assured me patiently. There was the sudden glimmer of tears in his eyes, and his arms around me tightened. The first night I came back here, I came through your window. I couldn't make myself look inside. I was too scared to look, because I wasn't sure you would be there, and when I finally saw you sleeping, Alina, peaceful and healthy and safe, and you were so damned beautiful, I can't even. His voice broke, and he clutched my upper arms tightly in his grip. A tear fell from his eye and ran down his cheek, and I started to cry too. I understood the moment he was describing, because I was living it myself, even as he described it.
I don't even have enough words to tell you about that relief, Moya Fistko. Suffice it to say that I was so relieved. I wept that night. I promise you, I will only take the risks I have to, because I truly understand how much it matters to you that I'm safe.
We sat like that for a long time, basked in a contented silence. For long minutes, I had everything I needed in the world again,
and I was happier than I could ever remember being. The shadow of reality loomed too soon, because as desperately as I wanted to, I couldn't stay with him like that forever.
I don't know how I can leave you, but I can't stay out much longer, I whispered eventually. If my parents notice me missing, they will pay more attention tomorrow, and I won't be able to come see you again.
Don't come see me again, he said. I gasped and moved to argue, but he shook his head and pressed his finger against my lips.
It's too risky, Alina. It's a miracle that I even saw you tonight. But, God help me, I can't stay away from you now. I will wait until it's very late, and assuming it's safe, I'll come to your window instead, okay?
You will?
I will, he promised. Then he sighed.
I should not, but I will.
I swallowed the lump in my throat at the reminder of the danger he was in, but he kissed me, and then gently disentangled our limbs. Then he rose and helped me to my feet, and we walked in silence back to the edge of the woods.
I love you, Alina, he murmured.
I love you too, so very much, I whispered.
We shared one last kiss in the moonlight before he gently propelled me toward the house. As I took my first few steps, he caught my hand, and I turned back to stare at him. We slipped through time then, back through the hard years to the night of our proposal. For a heartbeat, I was that same spoiled girl I'd been before the war, and he was the muscular, cocky boy who had proposed to me. Somewhere in time, that was who we'd always be, and I felt the certainty of that in my bones.
I can't help but think that this is a miracle, Alina, Tomas whispered, his gaze scanning my face. I can't help but think that you finding me tonight was a gift from God. Maybe he can forgive me after all.
The darkness was returning to his eyes. We had so much more to say to one another, and no time to even start the conversation.
We will talk tomorrow, Tomas, I whispered.
Yes?
He reluctantly released my hand, and his gaze darted to the field beyond me for a moment. Then he whispered,
Sleep well, moje fistko.
Be safe, Tomas.
The house was still silent when I climbed in my window. I pulled off my coat and shoes and climbed under the blankets. But even once I closed my eyes, I resisted sleep. Instead, I basked in the warm glow of something most remarkable, something almost miraculous. I was excited about his return, of course, but equally, I was relieved to welcome a glimpse of happiness and a glimmer of hope in my life again.
Chapter 12. Alice. I get up at 5 a.m. out of habit and not necessity on school days. I plan out Eddie's visual calendar, lay out his clothing, and then pack his school bag. The dreidel, which he's still taking with him everywhere he goes, his stuffed Thomas the Tank Engine toy just in case he wants it, 6 Go-Gurts, 1 can of soup, and 6 pairs of spare underpants, each with a matching Ziploc bag for the inevitable accidents.